Welcome back to another Wednesday Action Enneagram podcast. My name is Creek, and I'm with my snappy co-host, Mario Sikora. Snappy.
Do you have a definition for that word? Yeah.
One who participates in musicals is the official definition.
Really? Okay, well, I'm not a big musical guy. I got to be honest with you. I love movies, but musicals are not my thing. If you want to torture me, lock me in a room and force me to watch Baz Luhrmann movies.
I don't know who that is.
Yeah, well, he's a guy that does musicals.
There's a select few musicals that partially just because I grew up on them that, you know, like White Christmas, Singing in the Rain.
Well, I like the older ones, right? I mean, because that was a art form that is in time. Right. And and I will say that I liked Elena Perez, the one that was nominated for an Academy Award this year about how do you even describe that movie about the Mexican drug lord who goes through a sex change operation and, you know,
oh my goodness.
And his attorney and their relationship and, you know, and every so often they break out in song. And when it first happened, I'm like, what, you know, but I rolled with it and I enjoyed the movie. So,
wow.
There you go.
Old dogs, new tricks.
Yeah.
Great.
So
Marie Jose is not here with us today. She's apparently in a very long line,
which is not
to what or where. But
we just got a message that the line is very long and I won't make it. So apparently not very snappy in whatever line she's
very,
on.
Very not snappy. Yeah. That's great. You know, when you just have Mario and I in the room, it just ends up becoming a philosophical, epistemological conversation about the nature of knowledge.
Everybody has left already. So.
Yes. Yeah. But stick around. You might learn something, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, over the years of working with Awareness to Action and, you know, I have my own podcast and...
What is your podcast?
Fathoms.
Fathoms,
an Enneagram podcast. Right. Yes.
Yeah, pitch it, man. Come on. Pitch it. I encourage our listeners to listen to Fathoms, especially this season. You guys are doing a great job comparing the major Enneagram schools. And, you know, it's well worth the listen for our listeners.
Yeah, it's been a lot of work, but it's really great. So, but I've just seen how important these small, what we assume about how things work, the small assumptions we make, the lack of defining terms, how that leads to such vastly different conclusions. So what I'd love to talk about today, and we're just going to start here and see where it ends up over the next, you know, few minutes, but the terms that get thrown around, descriptive, prescriptive, and predictive are the three words. So I'll just throw those at you from your gut. You know, what are those definitions? And I will fact check you as you go.
So descriptive is, you know, describing something, right? It's, you know, I know you're not supposed to use the word, but it is listing the characteristics or qualities of something, right? So it's generally not evaluative, right? It's not necessarily making a judgment. It's trying to be objective and just, you know, to relay what something is like in a sense.
Yeah. I mean, you're not wrong. Actually.
Well, that's nice.
So,
it's a good start. One out of three, right? Yeah.
Describing or classifying in an objective and non-judgmental way. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to the Enneagram, I think most people would agree that it is a descriptive model. Mm-hmm. Where are the edges of that? Where does it stop being a descriptive model in your head?
So let's see. So for me, and I don't want to get ahead and, you know, pull our other words in here yet, but I will, I might. So for me, okay, let's, always define what we mean by the Enneagram. When we talk about the Enneagram, we're talking about the Enneagram diagram. Okay. Are we talking about the Enneagram of personality? If so, which version / interpretation of that? Okay, are we talking about? And then what set of claims are we making related to it? Or are we talking about other ideas that we drag in that are not necessarily related to either the Enneagram diagram or the Enneagram descriptions of personality type, and referring to that as the Enneagram, right? So, you know, a lot of times people will, you know, take some of these Neo-Gurdjieffian ideas that float through the Enneagram world and call those the Enneagram, right? I don't consider those to be the Enneagram. So if we stick with purely the Enneagram of personality and not the Enneagram as a process model, which I think is a pretty useless application of the Enneagram, but that's just my opinion. It's a descriptive model, end of story, right? And can it be used for prescribing action for growth? Absolutely, right? Does it in and of itself point to a prescription for continued growth? I'm not so sure, right? It's about how we apply it. Now, I'll also say that we have to be careful about how well the Enneagram can describe the thing that it's claiming to describe. And we have to define what it is we are claiming to describe by the Enneagram, right? So all these are, you know, it's a complicated question, right? So I think that it describes 9 patterns of personality, of habitual personality. I think that in particular, it reflects a preference toward, a non-conscious preference toward using one of those strategies more than the other 8, okay? From there, we can gather through empirical observation characteristics that are common to people who share that preferred strategy. But we also have to be careful that we're not assuming too much and drawing in other things into our description, such as the subtypes.
Yeah, I think with any description, you really have to know where the boundaries are.
Yes.
And are we describing, like in the ATA model, are you describing a process of what it looks like to strive to feel a certain way, or are you describing the essential form of what it is to be an 8 that is expressing itself through you, which spoiler is not ATA's approach.
Yeah, go back to listen to 600 other episodes on that topic, right?
And then like you said, like there's an over describing as well, that there's when you see nuance and variation, that there's a temptation to continue to add complexity in order to describe the variation. So it is a descriptive model, but at some point it ceases to be a helpful description.
Yeah, if the description is overly broad and therefore does not capture the reality of all the people of that particular type, for example, that we're trying to describe, right? So, for example, if, you know, we're describing, I don't know, 4s, and we're including in that description of 4s things that are true of, say, a transmitting 4 but not a preserving 4, then we're no longer really describing 4s. We're describing one subset of 4s that we call a transmitting 4, right? So we have to be careful about that. And so we have to ask ourselves, okay, what is, you know, what fits into the description of a 4 here? And then where are we veering off into where we're describing a subtype version of that, a cultural version of that, a gender-based example of that, you know, and so forth.
And I guess in some ways that the next word I'd like to talk about is predictive. And this one, to me, is a little bit, has a finer point to it, because like, as we've talked about, like, technically astrology is predictive too. Who's to say it's actually accurate in its prediction?
Yeah, right. Well, it attempts, I think.
It attempts to be right
prediction. Yeah,
and to a certain extent, it's like, yes, someone who navigates uniquely, you know, there is some predictive measure that you can put on someone's behavior, emotional patterns, you know, cognitive patterns, all of those. There's some, but how do we draw that end line, I guess, on where the prediction stops?
Yeah, I'm really uncomfortable with talking about prediction related to Enneagram type, primarily because I see too many predictions fall flat, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, he's a one, so he's always going to do the right thing, or he's an eight, so he's going to get angry at this, or, you know, she's a seven, so she's going to be the life of the party. And those things, you know, often are untrue. And so to assume that we can predict behavior based on a general tendency like Enneagram type is really dangerous, you know. And I've seen lots of people, you know, want to say, well, you know, we should use the Enneagram for hiring people because certain people will be good at certain jobs. And I'd say, well, they are until they're not. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's so much that goes into that, that the Enneagram is not usefully predictive, right? The way I think of it is that the Enneagram points to probabilities, okay, in a sense, right? So there's a higher probability that an eight will do this than somebody who's not an eight, right? But again, probabilities are not certainties. So, mm-hmm. You know, so I'm okay with saying it's a probabilistic model, mm-hmm. right? Because it, you know, there are tendencies, you know, and this is the way we always try to describe it when we do our descriptions of the types. We'll say, you know, well, eights have a tendency to do this, or they often do that. But we would never say eights do this, eights do that, because mm-hmm. nobody does anything all the time and everybody does everything some of the time. So, so I'm real uncomfortable with predictive.
Oxford Dictionary, predict, to say or estimate that a specified thing will happen in the future or will be a consequence of something.
Yeah.
So I think, what was the other word you said?
Probabilistic.
Probabilistic, yeah.
And I think it's also a retroactively explanatory model. Mm-hmm. I think that's where the real utility of it is, right, for me.
So predictive has a little too much certainty attached to it.
Yeah.
Oftentimes. Because we do, you know, when we've been talking about coaching a lot, when you are talking to an eight or a four, there is some level of prediction of how someone might respond if you approach them in a particular way.
Yes.
And our brains are doing predictions all the time. So it's maybe not leaning on, it's data to consider, but not to lean on exclusively or without nuance and flexibility.
Yeah. I often get comments, or I don't know if often's the right word, but I get comments on occasion from people who meet me for the first time and assume that because they know I'm a type eight, and I don't know, maybe it's because of my gruff but lovable persona on this podcast, they'll say, oh, you're actually a nice person, you mm-hmm. know, and I don't know how to respond to that, you know, it's relying on this predictiveness, you know, where you hear people, I remember this one Enneagram teacher referring constantly to eights as eight holes, you know, and thinking he was one, mm-hmm. but. Well, that causes a tendency to want to predict a behavior. Oh, there's this eight. He's going to be a jerk, right? Because that's what eights are. But, you know, you can you know, oh, look, a four who's laughing, you know, well, that mm-hmm. can't be, you know, a nine who is getting really aggressive and, getting into a fight, or a seven who's depressed and morose, you know, well, mm-hmm. Yeah, people are complicated.
Yeah.
But if I go back to the retroactive explanation of things, again, this is where I think that the Enneagram is really, really powerful, in that we can say, ah, man, you know, I went off track again, right? I screwed up. I'm experiencing friction, whatever it is. I recognize that something's not working. What is it about my Enneagram profile, my type, my instinctual bias, you know, that helps me understand why what just happened? Okay, mm-hmm. So I can kind of go back and look at it. And, you know, we often talk about the Enneagram as a problem resolution protocol, right? Look here, because it's the most common thing, but it might not be that thing. Mm-hmm. So the Enneagram helps us say, oh, yeah, this is why I did this. Mm-hmm. And then it allows us to come up with that path to correct the situation.
Yeah. And obviously, our brains are wired for... We want predictability.
Yes.
So we will seek to find it.
Yes.
And then we are upset when it doesn't pan out.
Yeah. Or we ignore when it doesn't pan out.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thinking more probabilistically instead of predictively is probably really great. So, and then I guess to transition to the other word of prescriptive, what you're saying about the retroactive, I think that's primarily what it's good for, but I can also see it, I use it this way of like, I'm about to enter this situation, knowing what I know about myself and about my subtype, there's some sort of like, it's not that I'm going to be doing this thing, it's that I need to be looking out for these things, and I like... the pattern of these things, the motivation, the process of me doing this thing that I'm overdoing or underdoing
No, you're right. And I would agree that's a good application of it, right? So, you know, we have lists of derailers for each of the types, right? And, and there are behaviors that we see when people do go off track. They often look like, you know, this, that, or the other thing. And it helps to remind ourselves that, yeah, you know, I want to be careful that I don't go off track in this way. I want to remind myself that this is, you know, this is what happens when I lose my temper, I turn into the Hulk, you know, or, you know, right. This is what happens when I drink too much, you know, whatever it is. We want to say, okay, be aware of a tendency to fall into this trap and take steps to mitigate the likelihood of that happening.
In what other ways do you see like the Enneagram of personality being a prescriptive model?
Yeah, so I'm real cautious about that, right? Because I am very cautious about, well, because you're an eight, you should do blank. And, you know, it used to be, and, you know, really nobody, you know, even the original teachers don't really teach it this way anymore. But it used to be, okay, you know, fours need to integrate to type one. So it's prescriptive for you as a four to take on the higher side of one as part of your growth and that sort of thing. And there's some usefulness to that, right? I mean, I wouldn't quite put it that way. But, you know, from my view, it helps to recognize how you distort the strategy of striving to feel perfect and how you might, you know, work on that to grow and integrate that so that you're not overcorrecting to avoid that strategy and so forth. So in that sense, you know, there can be a prescriptive element to it, okay? But I also think that the Enneagram works better in the context of a set of other tools, right? I think that the Enneagram should always be a piece of a toolkit and not the toolkit itself. And, you know, you can always kind of tell the amateurs when all they have is the Enneagram, right? And if they don't have other tools that they're using to, you know, a doctor has you know, when they write a prescription, you know, there's a whole, you know, series of, you know, or a whole plethora of things they could prescribe. And they will weigh that based, you know, not just on what the fundamental symptoms are, but the individual, right? What they know the person's tolerances or intolerances are, or the person's weight, or the person's age, or the person's overall health, right? So all these things that you have to look at. But, you know, the thing being is that they're reaching towards something outside and saying, okay, I've done the diagnosis. Now here's all the options I have for helping people, you know, get healthier. And it might just be, you know what, you need to stop eating so much and get some exercise and so forth. So anybody working with the Enneagram, you know, if all they have is the Enneagram, then they don't have much, quite frankly, right? So you've got to have other tools to use to prescribe growth and development, I think.
Yeah, I think it gives data, it gives context and suggested storylines as to what you're doing, why you're doing it, those sort of things, whether or not they be true. I mean, assuming you're typed correctly.
Yeah.
Right. And it may not even be Enneagram adjacent, right? But to me, the specific prescription is very personal, dependent on the person and the issue at hand. But the, you know, if someone is experiencing pain, there's a direction of travel that the doctor will go down to address that, you know? So that, to me, that's the extent of the Enneagram's prescription of like, here's where to look, but beyond the where to look and some potential specifics, it's mostly just personal. It's everything external to the Enneagram.
Yeah. So I want to be careful here because there are things that, you know, I almost always prescribe to people of a particular type, right? I can't think of a nine that I've worked with, for example, who I did not kind of as a baseline developmental thing say, I want you to observe your tendency to self-deprecate and, you know, work on not doing that, right? Now, it's Enneagram correlated, okay, because I see it as a common issue among nines. Now, does that mean that only nines do that? No, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are other people who need to work on their tendency, you know, to work to get over their tendency to self-deprecate, but I almost always see it in nines. So, does that make the Enneagram prescriptive in that way? You know, we're splitting hairs here, right? There's nothing in the Enneagram that says, you know, nines need to stop self-deprecating. We can explain it through the Enneagram, you know, what we know of from the Enneagram based on, you know, or to understand why nines do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But beyond that, there are going to be, like you said, very specific and individual things that need to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. And even that self-deprecation thing, it's still based off of the striving to feel a certain way. It's a second order, or maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So we can, again, we can retroactively understand it. Right. By saying, oh, yeah, well, they have a tendency to self-deprecate because they want to feel peaceful. One way to feel peaceful is not having conflict with people. One way to not have conflict with people is to not assert your needs, right? To not seem like you are being demanding on the world and so forth. So these are logical outcomes of that striving to feel peaceful. But even that will look different based on the different subtypes of the nine. Right, the preserving and transmitting, I'm sorry, preserving and navigating nine tend to self-deprecate a lot more visibly than the transmitting nine does, but the transmitting nine does it as well. The Enneagram actually benefits when we pare it down rather than fill it up, right? Because it has a lot more utility when you narrow down to first principles and understand that everybody is going to be a variation of those first principles. right? It helps with context. It helps with understanding what the real motivation is rather than a second or third tier motivation.
I see it as like there's other personality systems out there that are very complex. More words doesn't equal more accuracy. And it's almost like paring it down is like knowing a cooking analogy, knowing how to cook versus having a really long, complex recipe of like that it may or that complex recipe may or may not work, but it's better to know the theory of cooking or baking. That will get you much, much farther than having to rely on a really set of complex instructions.
Yeah, it's the teaching a person to fish thing, right? Mm-hmm. But boiling fishing down to its essence, in a sense, right? What are the real fundamentals? Where the the first principles of fishing, which I know as much about as I do about cooking. So, which is not much. There's the quote often misattributed, as far as I can tell, to Albert Einstein that says, a theory should be as simple as possible, but no simpler. And I think there's a lot of value in that, as long as we recognize the but no simpler part, right? I mean, we could say E equals MC squared is simple, but then when you try to understand it, it's like, it gets more complicated. Now, the Enneagram's not quite E equals MC squared, but if we can continue to take it back to, okay, what's really at the heart of this and focus on what is at the heart of this, or at least the way we're interpreting it, we can achieve a lot more. Right. We can string those notes together and create, a greater number of symphonies, I think that by getting more and more precise about what we're claiming, getting more and more clear about how what we're seeing and how what we're stating is related to those first principles leads to better practice, okay? Mm-hmm. And what that does, so take for example, okay, so I had somebody say to me one time, is a good friend who's been teaching the Enneagram for years, was teaching the Enneagram for years before she met me, and she's a seven. And she said to me one time, it always, always just keeps coming back to my striving to feel excited, right? It's just, that's just what keeps getting me into trouble. Now, there are different versions and manifestations of that. Mm-hmm. But if we get caught on the version and manifestation of it instead of the root of it, then we miss things that are not the specific manifestation that we're looking for, right? Mm-hmm. So the more practical and applicable version of the Enneagram is the one that's simpler, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, especially when results are involved.
Which I would hope they are all the time.
Right.
Why else are you doing this if you're not hoping to get some benefit from it?
Right.
Even if that result is, self-awareness that leads to, better relationships or more contentment.
Can't remember if I said this analogy on this podcast or another one, but like in music, we have an A chord, a collection of three notes.
That was on one of your mistress podcasts. I heard that you say this, but it wasn't on this one. Yeah.
Okay. So an A chord does not exist necessarily. It's a name that we've put on a collection of frequencies that we have observed, experienced, that go together.
Yes.
And so it's a convenient naming, so we don't have to remember the frequencies and how they relate and all the intricacies of it. And it's much easier when you're trying to play a song together to say, play an A chord.
Yeah.
Versus let's all play the different frequencies all at the same time. It's just far more complex and varied. And that's just, that analogy has continued to serve me in a lot of different ways. when thinking about this.
Yeah. And you know, I completely agree with that, right? And so, you know, and it's why I kind of rail against the essentialist, you know, an ontological interpretation of the Enneagram as it being this thing that exists mm-hmm. in reality rather than just a convenient label that we put on something and as a linguistic shortcut, right? Because we need linguistic shortcuts. And the problem with linguistic shortcuts is they always lead to confusion and misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, Popper said there's no way to communicate by which you cannot be misunderstood because, you know, just by the limitation of communication and, you know, the way that humans do it, you can't describe an A chord, you know, as it actually is mm-hmm. because there's no words for that. Right. So there's always going to be these limitations, which is why you kind of keep having to come back to an A chord. Now, you know, if you then go and then say, well, there's no such thing as an A chord, so let's not even bother talking about it. Well, you know, good luck having a band, you know, who can't, you know, decide what chord to start with. Right.
Right.
So you have to have a starting place with the acknowledgement that the starting place is a convenience.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, just continuing with the music theory analogy, like there are add-ons to the A chord that help complexify it and flavor it and give it a different feel. And those are important distinctions. Mm-hmm. But again, they're just representing different frequencies, complexifying it in the right direction to capture the nuance of whatever we're experiencing is the important part.
Yeah. And we can liken that to some of the overlays that we talked about before, right? I mean, so you take a four and is it a four from the United States or is it a four from France or is it a four from Ethiopia, right? Mm-hmm. Is it a male four, or a female four? Is it, in, you know, a transmitting four or a preserving four? You know, is it a 30-year-old four or is it a 70-year-old four? There are always going to be those sort of, you know, extensions and variations that are based on, you know, a variety of factors.
Mm-hmm. Based on context.
Yes.
The chord that came before and after that A chord will make that A chord feel much different.
Oh, yeah.
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 So.
And yes, and in different contexts, different types are going to be different, right? Which gets back to our predictive thing, right? Can we say that an A chord is always going to sound this way? No, if the context changes the mm-hmm. way it sounds, right?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. All right, folks. Well, thanks for tuning in if you made it this far. We will be back next week with who knows what. But Maria Jose did text us. She's finally out of the line. So,
so she'll be with us next time, unless there's another line to get.
All right. See ya. So.
Thanks for listening to the Awareness to Action Enneagram podcast. If you're interested in more information about Awareness to Action, their certification programs, or events, feel free to reach out to us through the links in the show notes or by emailing info@awarenesstoaction.com.